Hi and welcome. This is Douglas Lynn, and you're joining us for another episode of Insider Stories. I am joined today by Carter Hatfield of Perfect Storm MTG. He has been playing Magic since 1994. He wrote to me and said that he sells Magic cards as a full-time job. He's a quiet speculation insider. I really had to interview him and get his story out there. We've been talking to dealers on different levels over the past few weeks. I promised you we're going to get some backpackers and some binder grinder people in here, some casual people, but we've been hitting a lot of good interviews with good store owners, so I want to keep this train rolling. This podcast is brought to you by QuietSpeculation.com. If you want to talk about Magic Finance, it is the premier place to go. There's an insider service with premium articles, a private forum with lively discussions every day, and every now and then secret tips that about finance tips that people haven't gotten to the public yet. So if you're interested, check it out. You'll find the link in the show notes, of course. And we are going to dive in today. So, Carter, tell me a little bit about yourself outside of Magic.
Well, I am a father of three. I love music. And really, my family is the most important thing to me. And I'm very lucky that I have Magic as a way to support my family and let me be closer to them and spend more time with them. But I love music. I live in Michigan. I live in a town called Mattawan, which is about 10 minutes west of Kalamazoo.
Okay. So if somebody is holding up their hand now in mitten form looking at it, you would be under the thumb then, right?
I'm on the other side. I'm on the left side, probably the bottom left quadrant.
Okay, if you're listening to this while driving, please don't try and figure this out with your hand right now, but otherwise, now you know. So you mentioned that you do this for a full-time living. Do you have do you work at home then, or do you have a storefront?
We run the website out of part of my house. We have a little over a room dedicated to office space and storing inventory. And that's the good thing about selling Magic cards is they don't take up a lot of space.
Oh, yeah.
So you can have a lot of cards in a little room.
Yeah, they don't rot. They don't expire.
Yeah.
They don't corrode. And that's got to be nice, too, to be in the position where you're at home. So, you know, you're not a stay-at-home dad because you're working, but you are home. You're close to your family.
Indeed.
I know that I know people say, you know, I work from home, but I am far from being like the parent at home, because I know it's typically a whole lot of work when you're working at home anyway.
It is, and it's the good thing and the bad thing about working at home is, you know, my schedule is a little more flexible, but at the same time, you're never really gone. So if there's something to be done, it's right there to do. And sometimes that means we're working until midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, sometimes I get to take half a day off and go to my son's school and, you know, watch the parade.
Excellent. So it sounds like dealing Magic has really enabled a pretty comfortable and flexible lifestyle for you.
Absolutely.
So walk me through a typical day for you.
Let's see. We get up pretty early, check email, check the website, look at sales, get the kids ready for school, get the kids off to school, and then just do a lot of the, you know, answer any emails, check eBay, you know, answer offers, invoices, things like that. And then we're shipping until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes that's punctuated by picking a kid up from school. But, you know, usually it's a pretty solid day of shipping. And then we do a lot of our buying in the afternoon and evening.
Uh-huh.
So depending on what day it is, I'll be at a different shop or maybe at a convention or a local PTQ or something like that, vending. But, Lots of work, lots of Magic.
You know, and I remember I had chatted with Nick Beckfar for our interview last week, and he had said that one of the real struggles is getting inventory in and going to events. Basically, like the thing people don't realize is a whole lot of vendors go to events not really to vend, but to buy a whole lot of cards.
Yes.
And I was wondering how you get your inventory.
Well, I think in a unique position among people in my level. I've been a part of this community playing Magic for, you know, almost the whole time. I didn't get in Alpha.
Mm-hmm.
I got in around Revised. So I've been a member of the community for long enough that I've pretty much always been the go-to guy for cards in the area. You know, as soon as I was old enough to realize that there was a little bit of them to be made, I started you know, buying and selling a little bit on the side to support my habit, basically. Mm-hmm. And then a few years ago, I lost my job, so a buddy of mine and I decided, hey, let's, you know, we've always kind of done this on the side. Let's, mm-hmm. let's step it up a notch and see what we can do. And so I was already in the position where people were coming to me to sell cards or to, you know, buy cards.
Mm-hmm.
So finding inventory hasn't been the biggest problem. Sometimes, you know, finding the specific cards you want is tough because people don't always want to sell, you know, the best stuff. But
yeah,
I'm in a pretty good position here in Southwest Michigan where I'd be well known and don't have much of an issue getting inventory.
That's excellent. So you had mentioned that also that you were going into stores. Do you have relationship with stores where you can buy and sell there?
I do have relations with two of the local stores. I worked for one of them for a couple of years, helping them with their buy list and buying and selling and
mm-hmm.
and just keeping Magic together. And don't do that anymore, but they understand what I do, and I also help them currently, like, plan events, run events. I'm a level one judge. I've been a judge for, I don't know, whenever Mirrodin came out. That's over 10 years.
Yeah, isn't that shocking?
Oh, man. But so I help run events, and it's kind of a nice relationship where we both have a benefit. You know, my presence brings people into the store, so, you know, we both gain from it, I think.
Nice. And you had mentioned that you had started this with a friend of yours. Do you still work with a partner, or are you on your own?
I bought him out about 3 years ago. We're still friends. We've been friends since 1997.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was something we went into, and it got to the point where it was getting a little bigger and he didn't have time to put into it. So we agreed that the best thing to do was for me to buy him out. And he still buys and sells on the side, you know, at a pace that's better for him. But, you know, I run this on my own.
And that seems like an amicable split then. And I think I hear that story a lot from people that there's one person who wants to take it full time and the other is looking for a graceful out.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. It was, you know, it was very easy. You know, no one left unhappy. You know, we're still friends.
Mm-hmm.
Our families are friends. You know, we get along great. And I think everybody won. You know, we got to do what we want to do and make some money. And it worked out pretty well.
You know, when I had talked to Kyle Lopez, I had asked him how he sorted cards and got all the, you know, packing and shipping and filling orders put together, and he said he threw labor at it. So he has people who sort cards for him. How do you handle the thing where you bring in 2,000 or 3,000 cards in the course of a month? How do you sort and pack and inventory those?
I have two guys that work for me, one on a full-time basis and the other on a part-time to full-time basis, and their primary function is just managing the inventory. I give them cards, they sort them, they inventory them, and I don't really mess around with too much of that other than the high-end stuff that comes in. That's mm-hmm. something that I like to take care of myself. And then
it's that recurring theme that nobody likes to sort inventory.
Yeah, it's definitely the least profitable thing you can be doing. I mean, the person managing things should be, you know, buying cards and, you know, managing your prices, your numbers, and, you know, it's a lot easier, I think, to outsource the lesser functions.
Uh-huh. So how do you organize your inventory then?
Well, we have several shelves, large shelving units filled with monster boxes, and our inventory is sorted by set. And then within each set is sorted by card number. So basically it works out to things that are color sorted and then alphabetical within each color.
Okay, that's convenient then. So if you're looking for a card when they started putting set numbers on it, you look up what the card number is, you go to the bin, you pull it out, and then you're good?
Yeah, I mean, within each set, you know, because one set could be anywhere from one row in a monster box to three monster boxes, depending on, you know, how many goodies are in a given set. But within each set, we have dividers so that each color is separated. So if you're looking for a lightning bolt, you know where the red cards from M11 are.
Okay, interesting. So What is the, I know that sometimes when I'm buying cards on TCG Player, I'm seeing people selling a card for maybe 4 cents or 8 cents or 11 cents. And I'm thinking, even if I have this card in my box, I would rather pay somebody 11 cents to go find it instead of myself to find it.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, like, what's the bottom limit on how cheaply you want to sell a card for? Are you happy making those 11 cent sales?
You know, I used to be, We've kind of moved around in regards to that a little bit. We started out at a quarter, and then there are some things that I think you just can't really sell for a quarter. And so I think 15 cents is the cheapest we have anything marked at, and that's really not to make a profit, but it's more to so that our customers can have access to, you know, any card. And it's kind of a break-even point for us, but it to me it's a value to have everything in inventory so people don't have to go somewhere else or, you know, these meaningless cards.
Yeah, so do you sell on TCG Player?
Yeah, we're on TCG, Amazon, eBay, and then, of course, we have our own website.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I have heard one of the things we talk about on the Quiet Spec forums, a lot of the people who sell on TCG is the cart randomizer lottery. That you'll hit, and that maybe you'll have a cart where somebody has 70 cents worth of cards in it, and it says, like, you have to add up to a dollar.
Yep.
And I do this too. I look at it and then I go to the person's store and I find a few more cards to throw in to get me up to that dollar. Or maybe I switch my whole order over there or something like that. So I can certainly understand the value of having those low level cards to have everything in one place so that you win the lottery on the card optimizer.
Exactly. So you get a lot of people.
Oh, go ahead.
You get a lot of people who just want to build a deck, you know, and they paste their whole deck list into TCG Player, and they don't care who they buy from.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having those things in stock, they don't turn over. You know, it's not a big moneymaker, but you do win some sales just by having, you know, the random common from Tempest Block in stock.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had mentioned that you had been playing, did you say, since basically 1994?
That's correct.
So when did you first get the taste of Magic Finance?
Taste of Magic Finance.
Did you trade early on, or?
No, I was a big noob for the first several years I played. Most definitely, I would say. Let me see. I want to say it was around 1999,
uh-huh.
Somewhere around there. You know, I realized that there was some money to be made, and it was something at first I didn't really do to make a lot of money. I was 19 years old, didn't have a good job, so I was able to, you know, pay for my magic habit by, you know, having the right cards for people at the right time, and it just kind of slowly evolved from there.
And I'm trying to think, 1999 was an era where, obviously, we didn't have smartphones, we didn't have internet pricing. I don't even think eBay was really a thing at that point, as far as, I think, actually, so far back, I remember on eBay, before PayPal, when you would send checks or cash to people with sleeves, and then they would put the cards back in the sleeves and mail them back to you. I don't know if you go that far back with eBay.
I don't go that far back.
Yeah.
Thankfully, those sound like dark days.
Yeah, dark days. I mean, for whatever PayPal did, it also cleared that stuff up. But, you know, that was kind of an era where your price guide may have been Inquest, you know, or Scry.
Yeah, that was kind of right in, we were moving away from those printed guides. We realized they were a little too slow to really keep up with things, but there was not, you know, a go-to, you know, you couldn't just look on eBay. You could, I mean, eBay was a thing, but you couldn't just go on your phone and look on eBay. You had to kind of memorize things, and a lot of people went by, you know, the shop has this card for $5, or the shop has this card for $7,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, TCG has this at, you know, $3.40 on the mid, and it's trending down, so, you know, there was none of that back then.
Yeah, and you know, that was an era of the $8 Royal Assassin.
Yes.
And the $20 Vizuvan Doppelganger. And it's interesting, you know, when you talk to people who have old sets that they want to sell, and you tell them, like, most of these cards are worth nothing, but some of these random cards are worth quite a lot. And it's always sad to be like, dude, Shivan Dragon is a quarter.
Yeah. People get very surprised, though, when they find out this land is worth $100.
Yeah. Yeah, so you started then. How did you transition into buying and selling? I know you said you started full-time a couple years ago. Did you start selling things online through eBay or stuff like that?
Yeah, I had always, I shouldn't say always, but since about 99, 2000, had eBay as a way just to kind of as an out, you know, a way to sell things and get that money. And then we started, you know, buying things and selling things for people on eBay, sometimes even on a commission basis if someone didn't want to sell their, you know, ancestral recall for, you know, what someone would pay for. I say, well, you know what, I'll sell it and I'll take a percent on top of eBay's fees and PayPal's fees, and then you can make a little bit more money, and I still make money and don't have a big risk. And, you know, that wasn't a great way to make money, but it was a very good way to build trust in the community. Mm-hmm. And
it's risk-free also, because you're selling, you have no cost basis in it.
Exactly. You know, the only thing that we have to lose is time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're 22 or whatever I was back then, you have all the time in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it and I think, like, I'm an adult now with responsibilities, and I look back at, like, what $80 meant to me then and what $80 means to me now, and it's just a gulf of difference.
Absolutely.
So you've been playing for a long time. What is your favorite card?
My favorite card of all time has to be Mind's Desire.
Oh, good choice.
Storm is my favorite mechanic, you know, hence the name of the company, mm-hmm. and that is most definitely my favorite card to play with.
I like Mind's Desire a lot. I remember for a hot minute when it was legal in Vintage, and you could do the Lion's Eye Diamond tricks with it as a four of.
Yeah, it's a one of now, and sadly, it's, you know, just a little bit too. It's a very all in card, mm-hmm. you know, so you don't see it in a lot of deck lists, but. It's usually in my Vintage deck.
And also, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, not a very expensive card to buy.
Yeah, it's true. It's it is what it is.
It's easy enough to put together a collection of them. So when you're working on this, you know, did you do a lot of tournament play? Do you still do a lot of tournament play?
That's probably the biggest downside. To uh-huh. doing this for a living is you don't get to play nearly as much as people think you do. I play very little, actually, these days. You know, most of my time at tournaments or the card shop or any event is spent trading, buying, or selling.
Yeah.
I get to squeeze games of EDH or maybe test a little bit of Legacy and Modern here or there, but pretty much usually flipping through a binder or making stacks of cards.
So when you're filling orders, how much can you tell the proportion? Are the orders are people buying competitive stuff or like the list of 31 of that you know is an EDH deck?
That's a good question. I would say it's a 50-50 split, but about half of what goes out in a given day are standard cards.
Uh-huh. Oh, usually, interesting. If that much.
It might be 40%, but it's a large percent, usually in four ofs, and then the rest is usually a pretty good mix of casual cards, you know, lots of randoms, with some Modern and Legacy sprinkled in, but uh-huh. casual is a close second to standard, I would say.
So, see, that's interesting to me, because when I talked to Nick Beckbar, he said standard is really where all the money is at as a dealer. You have to have lots of good standard stock, and you move it quickly.
I mean, standard definitely is where the money is at. The downside of standard is the prices are a bit more volatile, especially right now, you know, with cons. People yeah. are opening so much cons that these cards that are staples, you know, Siege Rider was like $6, and Mantis Rider is, what is Mantis Rider, like $3 or $3.50?
Yeah, and the Jeskai Ascendancy shot up to $8, and we were telling everybody on QS, like, this is not a stable price sell, and then it dropped back down to $3, and now it's moving a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it, I think, at $2.50 before the combo deck won, last weekend or mm-hmm. the weekend before. But standard definitely is where a lot of the money is. I sell a lot of EDH cards, you know.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, I like having kind of everything in stock. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of just weird decks that people build, you know, core decks and spirit decks. And, you know, you can kind of almost tell the EDH deck that the general people are building around by, you know, these random commons that they're buying.
That's wild. I mean, I just love that Commander has given a new life to those cards that you would find in collections that are, you know, theoretically worth money, but nobody, there's not much of a local demand for it.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I think the banner card for this is Scarecrone. And sure. That's a card that, like, you could have in your binder for years and nobody would touch, but there's, like, there are casual players or EDH players who really want that. It's like a $9 card, but nobody would ever trade for it from your binder. It's so low velocity.
Exactly. And I actually like targeting stuff like that because EDH players will buy it. I'll never have too many of them in stock.
Mm-hmm.
And most Magic players don't care about these cards. You know, they're never sad to trade Scarecrones or what have you into the fetch land they need. And, you know, it's a win-win. They get rid of something that they consider almost toxic because it's been in their binder for months. And I get something that I know I can flip right away. And I get to provide a service to this guy. Hey, you got your last Misty Rainforest. Awesome.
Yeah. So you had mentioned, I mean, those are cards that, like, they're not volatile in price. I mean, they might shoot up, but they're never going to drop down, barring a reprint. How do you handle the volatility of standard cards and make sure that you're buying them at a price that you're not going to lose money when you sell them later?
You know, that's a good question. Standard is something that, for the first year or two, I kind of stayed away from and stuck more into Legacy, and then as Modern became a thing, into Modern. Standard definitely is much more of a time commitment. You know, you have to be a lot more aware of tournament results and, you know, what are the pros playing, what are people writing articles about this week, and you just have to, you know, try really hard to stay ahead of the curve. You know, if a card starts dropping, you know, Sarkhan's $40, all of a sudden Sarkhan's $35, okay, well, we can't hang on anymore, we got to get ahead of this price drop.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it means aggressively lowering your price so that you're not constantly chasing the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're, and you know, I remember when Dig Through Time, it shot up to $15, and now you can get, the medium price is $9. You can get sets for $6 to $7 a piece here on TCG Player. And I know that a lot of people who are starting out in Magic Finance, sometimes we get some people on Quiet Spec who say, you know, is this a $20 card? You know, I bought mine at $3 or $5. How much higher can it go? And there's that thought of, like, cons is going to be open. The price is going to drop. And you need to get out while the getting's good. So that seems to speak to your idea of wanting to aggressively price things to move.
Absolutely. And more so with Standard than with anything else. I mean, it's really, you know, a flavor of the week format a lot of times.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you run the risk that, or you have the opportunity that maybe Travis Wu is going to brew something interesting this week and you're going to sell a whole lot of Villainous Wealth or Narsets or something.
Yes. It usually, with cards like that that have this potential for explosiveness, I will intentionally only list a limited number of them because, you know, if we have, say, 20 Narsets, how many do we need to have in stock at one point, really?
Yeah.
Eight, you know, yeah, maybe.
You're right. I mean, you're not going to get a run of somebody on Narset.
Yeah, and if we sell out, you know, we'll list more. But if you know, something happens and the card explodes, I like to have them to, you know, to provide to our local customers, not to, you know, someone who's, you know, just buying them out.
Absolutely. And, you know, that seems to speak to you, you know, your success being a local player and being a trusted local source for selling.
Dude.
Do you ever advertise on, is there a local Facebook group in the area you're in for Magic?
I run one. It's called the Kalamazoo Magic Family. We've got about 200 people.
Excellent.
And then I admin several groups across the state for buying and selling and trading and just community stuff.
And I think a lot of players don't realize that that is a free resource, and it's also a way that, you know, you can offer better buy prices to people in unobtrusive ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, people are looking at, like, how do you get into buying and selling, and that's one way you can do that. I know people who will post a buy list on buying and selling and trading groups where they're basically just, they want to make a standard deck, but they don't want to pay retail, so it's like, I will pay 75% of retail for any of these cards on this list. And, I mean, that's an easy way to save 25%, but people don't even realize they can do that.
No, I think Facebook is an amazing tool for buying and selling cards. I love it. I do the same thing. I'll post my buy list, but also as a vendor, I'm happy to give a discount to these people because, you know, if I sell this card on eBay or TCG Player, I'm going to pay TCG fees and PayPal fees.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Crystal Commerce fees and postage. And there's a very, very small risk that something could happen to it in the mail. I mean, it's less than 1% of the time that that happens, but it does happen. So, you know, if I can make a local person happy, fill their deck, save them some money, that there's a benefit to them and a benefit to me because they said, hey, Carter took care of me before, so next time we're going to call Carter up when we need some cards.
Absolutely. Excellent. So you had mentioned that, you know, Cons is being opened in, I think it's in record numbers. I haven't seen a set
It's got to be.
In a long time. Where do you see the fetch land settling in price?
You know, I have to agree with the conventional wisdom that they're going to drop to a bottom and then eventually slowly gain over time, probably once they rotate out of standard. I feel like it's hard to imagine blue fetch lands below $10.
Uh-huh.
That it seems that, you know, it just seems hard to believe that they could be less than that amount. And non-blue, even non-blue below 10 feels wrong, but, you know, I mean, looking at, like, shock lands and standard, you know, definitely wasn't uncommon to see, you know, $7, $8 price tags on them. So, you know,
yeah.
Maybe on the black sheep, you know, we see $7 or $8 on one or two for a little bit.
So there are a whole, like most of the cards and cons are going down because people are listing their prices, selling them to dealers, people want to move them. Are there any cards and cons you can identify that you've been seeing a solid upward trend on?
Not too much. Siege Rhino has been pretty stable.
Mm-hmm.
The fetch lands have been pretty stable in the demand for them, even as the price falls. We still can't really keep them in stock at fair prices.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. It's tough. You know, even Sarkhan is getting to, you know, low 20s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had them at, I think, 23 or 24 on TCG all week and haven't sold one on TCG.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and I've pulled up, I don't know if you use MTG Stocks at all.
I do.
They have their interest page for listeners. It's a fantastic resource. I'm looking at the last week, all the gainers, and I'm looking for the highest gaining Cons of Tarkir card. And it is Jeskai Ascendancy, and over the past week it gained 5% value, which was 18 cents. So that's the only card in Cons that's gone up.
I believe it. It's
so
tough.
To the people out there, if you're listening, bear this in mind that if you're saying, well, when is this card going to go up? When are is my Polluted Delta going to go up? But no is the immediate answer. As long as Cons is being opened and sold, no.
Yeah, these cards aren't going to rise for a year, probably, barring a new archetype or a new deck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually, I had tools earlier today looking at our inventory versus the spread and having, you know, being able to sort by spread in a set is just an amazing thing because Sarkhan, as an example, was $22 on a buy list and $23.50 TCG mid.
Wow. And were you using trader tools on Magic or on Quiet Speculation for that?
I was.
And for listeners who are, whether you're an insider or not, Trader Tools is a function that we have on Quiet Speculation. You have access to it if you're an insider. It aggregates buy lists and sell prices, and you can sort. What Carter's talking about is you can sort by the percentage difference between the buy and the sell price. We call it the spread, and the idea is that a card with a low spread, they tend to move more quickly. And that's why dealers will pay more for them and pay closer to market value because they know they can get rid of them. A card with a high spread is something that dealers are unwilling to pay a lot for because they do not move quickly. And you also will see a lot of Cons cards with a high spread because it's exactly the volatility Carter's talking about where the prices keep going down and so you can't end up paying a whole lot. But one of the functions is that you can search by set in it and see what cards in a set have the highest value, the best buy list prices, the best spread. So you use that as a resource too?
I do occasionally. I like to use it to monitor our buy list prices and make sure we're not paying too much or too little for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes it's nice because we're selling a card for $23 and someone else is paying $21. It's like, well, hey, after my fees, I'm only getting $20. So maybe I'll just sell it to this guy if I have too many in stock. You know, it's a good way to get rid of excess stuff, and these guys aren't going to buy it unless they need it,
mm-hmm.
in theory. So, you know, everybody wins.
So how does that make you feel when you have a card in inventory and you know it's, you know, you got it for $23.50 mid, and you know somebody's paying $21 on it? How does that make you feel?
Well, I guess it depends on what I paid for the card.
Fair
you
answer.
Know, I got burned really hard on Domri last year
when
green-red monsters was a big thing. It took us a while to get some in stock, and I think we may have overpaid a little bit, and and then it was one of those situations where, man, this card is just going down. You know, we almost should just out it to a buy list because they're paying a lot. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's a really nice feeling because, you know, in the example of Sarkhan, you know, I can just sell six of them right now and get as much or maybe a little more than I would if I sold them online.
Yeah. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And I remember, you know, a lot of the dealers and people I talk to, they keep track of buy list prices too, because the easiest customer to sell to is another business.
Yeah.
You know that they pay, you know that they'll pay on time, they're not going to quibble with you about stuff. And it's a great market resource to be able to go and ship that, or like shop your inventory around every day and see what you can get for it.
Indeed. Especially with the, you know, there's a very specific list of vendors on Trader Tools, so you know that you're not going to get some guy who doesn't pay you for 2 weeks or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah, it's vetted people who the insider community trusts to be sending their stuff to. Okay, so you talked about Domri being maybe a card that you overpaid for. I always ask people this. What is in your box of shame of cards that you're ashamed to have bought?
You know, I do have a box of shame, as much as we don't like to admit it. I don't have anything that I paid too much for, I think. It's more, I tend to spec on cards that are cheap. I don't like to have, you know, $10 cards in my spec box. I like to have cards that are 50 cents, a dollar, because when they go to $3, you're making a lot more than, you know, a $5 card going up by $3.
Definitely.
But I do, we have about 200 infinite reflections in the box.
I have to look that up.
it basically makes every creature in play a copy of the enchanted creature. And I think BioVisionary got printed, and I said, man, I wonder if people are just going to make these decks with Mana Dorks and then Infinite Reflection them so that we have a bunch of BioVisionaries out and win the game. And it was a bulk rare. You know, I didn't spend a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not mad about buying them. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about it on this interview. But I did go a little too deep on that card.
I mean, that is an interesting combo, though.
Yeah.
We'll start brewing with that. I always ask people this. I'll confess, my box has about three dozen Hermit Druids sitting in it, because at one point a long time ago I thought that might be unbanned in Legacy, and that tells you what I knew.
Yeah, good luck with that.
But that was one of those cards that was like 50 cents to buy, and I thought it hits big.
Yeah, you know, I like speccing in cards like that because there's very little downside. You know, if it stays a bulk rare, you didn't really lose, you know, any money. I mean, if I sold them out as bulk rares, I would lose maybe 15 cents a card. And, you know, we don't like to lose any money, but it happens sometimes. And if the card goes up to a buck, you know, you tripled up. So.
Yeah. You know, and that's what we talk about, too, with people, is that, like, if you have $10 to speculate on, you can buy one $10 card and hope it goes to 15 and you make $5. Or you can buy 20 50-cent cards, and if they go up to a dollar, then you made $20.
Exactly.
Or $10 right there, actually. I got to do the math right. But the sentiment is the same. It's about, you know, the scalability of a card like that. So we talked about the bad calls. What have been some of your victory calls?
I did really good on Ravnica Black. I'm sorry, Ravnica Standard Mono Black. We bought a lot of pack rats, a lot of Nail Specters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I had 20 or 30. No, I probably had more than that. I had a large stack of each that I paid a quarter or 50 cents for. Night Vale Spectre had started to see a little bit of play in Vintage, and it was, hey, if this card is Vintage playable, it's probably playable in other formats. And then I don't remember when the deck took off exactly, but I remember being very happy that we had a large stack in our box.
Wonderful. I think Pack Rat was one of those cards, too, that you know, people realized how devastating it was in draft, and it was only a matter of time before it worked somewhere.
Indeed.
So when you're buying cards and you're looking at collections and things, do you like to go to like high end stuff or casual stuff, or we talked about standard before? Like, what's in your ideal collection that you guys are buying?
You know, I like to have casual stuff and standard stuff.
Uh-huh.
I find that high end legacy stuff is like Force of Will as a good example.
Uh-huh.
Those are great cards to have. But really, they don't turn as fast as a card like Anger of the Gods. And from a percentage standpoint, you know, you have to pay more for a card like Force of Will,
mm-hmm.
because it's an expensive card, it's an iconic card, and it's a rare card. Whereas cheaper staples like Anger of the Gods or Purphoros, Erebos, you know, you can get those for a lower percentage, and they turn much, much quicker.
So you, you can, it's that velocity thing.
Absolutely.
What challenges are you facing right now with your business?
You know, it is tough to stay ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, pricing cards and, you know, making sure that your prices are competitive and you're not, you know, pricing yourself out of things. It's very easy to price things so that you can sell them, but, you know, making sure that you make enough on a card, you know, it's a tough balance. It's like, hey, we want to sell this card, but we also want to make enough money to have it be worth buying this card. You know, we're in a phase right now where I'm looking to add content to the website.
Mm-hmm.
We've been hiring some new writers and are getting ready to start publishing a lot of content. So I've been putting a lot of time into that, reading articles, proofing articles, just, you know, getting the website ready. And that's really been the biggest challenge is getting all of these ducks in a row.
And man, if you want to talk about boring jobs and sorting cards and inventories, doing grammar editing on articles is just right up there with that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what a grind. What a grind.
So it sounds like you're saying also that you want to be moving to the next level of bringing in more customers to the website and being less reliant on things like TCG.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, you move through a lot of cards. I would imagine that you've moved through quite a few pieces of power. Is there anything that's still cool when you buy it?
I really like seeing old, like, Legends and earlier cards mm-hmm. that are in really nice shape. And I'm kind of a sucker for misprints. But misprints are, like, one of those things that are very hard to purchase because, you know, they're hard to sell, they're hard to establish a price for. And... but I really like, you know, miscut cards or cards with, you know, weird oddities like a color splotch or, you know, something that's way off center. Those are the things that really, really make me smile.
So those are the things that you go for and maybe you dip in and grab them for your own collection?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, against my better judgment.
See, and misprints are one of those things that I hear from people. It's like, yeah, exactly the problem of, how do you price this? One person thinks it's $300, and the person buying it will offer $10.
Yeah, I usually just ask, you know, hey, what do you think this card's worth? And if we're off by a bunch, I don't even, you know, I tell them how cool it is. I think this card is awesome. I'm just really not interested in it because I don't want to offend this guy because the card is awesome. But I'm just, you know, I can't spend my money on, you know, this weird card with a white splotch in the middle of the picture.
Yeah, and I also know from people that, like, misprints are real binder poison because you're never going to trade them off for what you think that they're worth.
Yeah, alters are the same way. You know, some people really love alters, but most people just want the normal card.
You know, and I think of it, like, I remember I had read a long time ago when the first Fast and the Furious movie came out, they had all those tricked out cars in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were just junking them afterwards because they couldn't sell them. And the reason being that people who tune their cars like that, they want to make it their own car. They don't just want to buy a pre-made one. And
yeah, I believe that.
I feel it's that way with alters, too. Like, why do I want somebody else's vision of what they want on their car and Liberated? I want my vision of it on them.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I just had a guy bring me some Tarmogoyfs, and one of them was altered. He only wanted to sell the playset. Man, I don't even want this one specific guard Goyf. I just don't even want to touch it. And it's nice. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, and I feel like people don't want to hear you say, I mean, I will treat that as a damaged card and pay you damaged prices on it, but I think even signatures are that way now.
You know, and foreign cards are also the same way. It was all the rage for a long time, and now it's almost more of a liability.
I have no idea why that is either. I mean, I remember like non-foil Japanese cards were big.
Yeah.
You know, because if you can't afford the Japanese foil, you can at least get the non-foil. And now they are, like, nobody wants them. Nobody wants these things.
I thought it was just around here, because that was one of the when I first started doing this a little bit more seriously, like, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I had a guy in Japan that I could buy cards from, and he just wanted English cards. So yeah. I could buy his Japanese mystical tutor for, you know, the price of an English one, or maybe a little bit more, mm-hmm. but I could sell it over here for, you know, $30.
Yeah.
Where it was, you know, $5 for an English one. And now it's like the opposite. People just want to, you know, they want to read their cards. And maybe that's because Cube is a thing, or, you know, people are playing EDH, so they're not, you know, the other people they're playing with are not so serious. They want to be able to read the cards. I don't know.
But I found that when I got heavy into Modern that I switched all over to English because people just didn't know what cards did,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes I didn't. It's like I know functionally what Tormod's Crypt does, but I don't know whether it targets you or what it's targeting here, you know?
It's true. I lost a game because I thought Cryptic Command bounced a creature, and I could have bounced a Leyline of Sanctity with it, but I really thought it bounced a creature, and my Japanese Cryptic Command, you know, didn't do me any good.
Yeah, and I think enough people are feeling frustrated about that, but I think you've got a good point about Cube, is that people want their foils, they still want that stuff, but they want their English foils now because people have to read it.
Indeed.
Do you ever see big foil orders coming your way?
Sometimes we'll see. You can tell when people are ordering for the Cube. It's like 30 cards, and they're all foil commons and uncommons. You know, maybe there's one, you know, nice card in there, like a foil Sylvan Scrying or Crop Rotation or something.
Yeah.
But we get a really diverse, you know, mix of orders, and it's almost like a fun game to say, you know, what is this guy even doing with these cards?
You ever think about adding a note or emailing them? Like,
sometimes I do. Usually if I can tell someone's building a Storm deck, you know, I'll write a little comment on the invoice or toss in a coupon code or something, because it's it's dear to my heart.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's not a very fun archetype either. So you are really knowledgeable about Magic Finance, but what do you want to know more about?
You know, I really like knowing more about the science behind the game. I think that it's not that hard to make money buying and selling cards, but I really love reading articles about not just how to play this deck or how, you know, how to beat this deck, but like next level stuff. Like, I like hearing people talk about, when they're playing a deck, you know, this is what this deck wants to be doing. You know, this is what you want to be doing on turn two and turn three. And I like reading that higher level, you know, how to play stuff, and how to think about things instead of just kind of casting what's in your hand.
And I think that we are 10 years into serious Magic journalism, you know, like, to where there are sites that seriously pay people to write routinely. And still that kind of article is few and far between.
Yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, one of the most valuable things for me is reading an article about how to sideboard.
Oh, and those are so hard to find.
And it's easy to say, okay, well, I want my duresses in this matchup because I'm playing it's a combo deck.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what do I take out? And why do I take out this card? And, you know, reading about that and why people take out cards and maybe this card out on the play versus the draw, I really like reading that kind of stuff.
And then when you find that stuff where people have truly interesting strategies, it feels like you're looking behind the curtain in the Wizard of Oz, and there's really cool stuff.
That's exactly what it feels like.
And I mean, I feel like staying on top of reading the strategy stuff probably really helps you when you're dealing with standard cards.
It does. You know, you can't really see the future because things come out of left field a lot. But you know, if a deck becomes big, you can kind of predict how people are going to try to deck. So you can say, okay, I think people are going to start playing this card because it is really good against this Abzan strategy everybody's on. And, you know, it's a risk. It is a form of speculation, but it's, you know, it's an educated guess.
You know, and also one of my thoughts was that when the Pro Tour happened with Cannes, and that one of the very high placing Abzan or junk lists didn't run any Sylvan Caryatid and didn't run any Chorus Roof Crucifix. That's one of those things I thought where people have got to pay attention to this, because this is one of those evidence of absence things that we got to pay attention to, because this means this card's going to dip down a little bit in price if it does well.
Yeah, and if you're not aware of that kind of thing, you can find yourself really chasing the bottom, and that's not something you want a $20 card.
Yeah. So what advice do you have for listeners about if they want to follow in your footsteps here?
If you want to make a living selling Magic cards, probably the biggest thing that you can do is to be honest and fair and take care of everyone that you deal with. I've really been very lucky that I have a good reputation in the community. People come to me, but they do that because I've been honest with them. If people leave a binder behind when they go, when they leave the store, I make sure it gets back to them. If someone, leaves a card, I make sure people get their cards. I make sure they get fair prices. If I find a really expensive card in someone's bulk, I'll call them up and say, hey, there's a card in your bulk worth $20. I'm going to put an extra $10 in store credit on your order or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff really, people remember that. And that is really, I think, the first thing you have to do is have that sterling reputation where people can't question you. And people will just trust you implicitly.
That's phenomenal advice. I think a lot of people, when they get to like Reddit MTG Finance and they talk about how they ripped off people in their store, at Quiet Spec we're always really bearish on that, and we say, you can't keep that up. You're gonna poison your reputation, and you're going to poison the entire idea of trading in your community. Whereas if you're an upstanding person and you work with people, then it's going to flourish. And Carter, I think your story is a great example of that.
Thank you. And I tell people that it just makes sense, because do you want people to look up every single price you quote them? No.
Yeah, what a pain.
You want people to trust you. So if you want people to trust you, you have to make them trust you.
Mm-hmm.
Put it out instead of, scumming people over and then they're checking prices, they're double checking, make sure you didn't snag an extra card. It's just not worth it. It's not. There's no long-term benefit to it.
Yeah, and there's still plenty of money to be made in trading cards where you're not trying to just rip somebody off and get cards from a young kid for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, that's an example of your story's an example that you can be upstanding and on board, and if you create and help foster a good Magic community around you, there are going to be more people who are interested in trading and playing, which creates a great local market.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Carter, you have been a wonderful guest here, and we will be certain to have you back again. Really appreciate you coming on. Again, listeners, Carter's store is perfectstormmtg.com. Carter, are you on Twitter?
Yes.
What's your handle there?
PerfectStormMTG.
Okay, so go ahead and add him on Twitter. And if you haven't added Quiet Spec, do that too. It's Quiet Spec. And you have been listening to another episode of Insider Stories brought to you by Quiet Speculation. You can find all of our back episodes on mtgcast.com as well as on quietspeculation.com, and you'll be able to find our RSS feed so that you can automatically subscribe to these and get your latest shows delivered to you automatically. So thank you for listening. I'm Doug, and this has been Insider Stories.